Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much indeed for coming this evening to this discussion between two stars of stage and screen and radio. I just said to Professor McCulloch that I was going to be very brief, and he said, oh, good. my brevity is approved of by one of this evening's main speakers. I'm always delighted to support any function organized by our Faculty of Theology, not just because it's very good, but because even by Oxford standards, it's very good. Also because of the enthusiasm with which it pursues its scholarship and the enthusiasm which those it teaches shows. One of the most moving things that I've read about the university was perhaps slightly improbably in the last brochure produced by the Faculty of Theology when some of our theology students were asked about their courses and what they'd got out of reading theology at Oxford and what they hoped to do in the future. If I had a copy tonight, I'd read one or two of those fragments of autobiography to you and bring a few tears to several eyes. It's very moving to see how passionate some of these young men and women are about their studies and how much that passion is engendered by the teaching they receive from Dermot and his colleagues. Anyway, that's enough of me. We've got tonight, as I said, two great stars. Dermot McCulloch, whose History of Christianity, following his earlier book on the Reformation, took the scholarly world by storm, won prizes, sold in prodigious quantities, even withstood a rigorous critique of its index from one of Dermot's colleagues. But it's a very, very, very fine book indeed, and an easy way into it if you haven't read it, and if you haven't read it, spend the summer reading it. An easy way into it is to start with the review by Rowan Williams, which I think was in The Guardian, which is all that an author could hope for. So Dermot's going to talk a bit about his book in conversation with Melvin Bragg, Lord Bragg, talking about his latest book on the King James Bible, the Book of Books. Melvin Bragg, you all know, and I guess that probably more than half this evening's congregation audience will have spent from about 3 minutes past nine this morning till 9:45 learning about yet another subject from Melvin and his guests. I've long known that the ideal companion on any car journey is the podcasts of In Our Time with Melvin. He's a fine novelist, of course, and I guess could lay claim to being one of the, if not the foremost public educator of the modern age on radio and television. Somebody who's always believed, in the words of Adlai Stevenson, that the average man is a great deal, and woman, the average man and woman are a great deal better than the average. Melvin and Dermot will talk about their respective books. I'll now shut up, but I would like, when you all ask questions after about 25, 30 minutes, to ask one or two myself. Who's going to start? Dermot's going to start.
Well, I chose a rather mischievous title, and Mr. Chancellor and Lord Bragg graciously accepted the title, The King James Bible, The End of the Road, question mark. And one of the reasons I did that is that both Melvin and I have spent quite a lot of this year talking about the King James Bible and writing about it. And I wondered, after all the words that we had put in, what remained. And so that was part of my agenda in setting us up in this way. And I wonder if Melvin would like to talk a little about what drove him to write a book about the King James Bible.
Thank you. Well, can you hear me at the back? Yes, is that all right? Fine. Well, the structure of this evening's conversation is entirely the responsibility of Professor McCulloch. He devised it, he sent me an agenda about it, so it's I'm in his hands, and I couldn't be in better hands. I just wanted to make that clear. Sorry, dammit. The reason for why I wrote this book on the King James Bible, to be brief, because there are always quite a cluster of reasons why people write books. It's partly because I hadn't any more energy to write another novel after the last novel I published, which was about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. And I wanted to get to grips with something that would be taxing. And of course, the anniversary loomed, 1611 to 2011, and that was very much foregrounded. And I'd been brought up, I wouldn't say rigorously, but I'd been deeply saturated in Anglicanism from the age of about 6 to 18 or 19. I'd been hauled into the choir in 1945 by a couple of my uncles in the church in Wickton. And because of that, I must have heard reams of the King James Bible, as well as the English Prayer Book, and sung psalms and hymns, and was I got the best education I ever had in anything, in the unconscious education I got in that church. And we also were lucky enough to have two very good preachers along the way, one of whom was Anna Ford's father, rather dramatic preacher, but a very good one. So there's that background, so I've always been interested in it. My own faith is something I'm prepared to talk about, but later I'll try to answer Dermot's question on the nose. When I thought about what was being celebrated, it was clear that quite a few books would be written about how the King James Bible came to be written. And it's a tremendous story. And that's a story that I tell in the first few chapters of my book, but that's not the story that I really wanted to tell. I also thought that people would speak out and well and with great excitement about the contribution to English language and English literature of the Bible, particularly in my case, because I champion him, the works of Tyndale. I think that Tyndale is a genius of translation and Shakespeare is a genius of imagination, and the two of them together were the thatch which on which for the last 400 years we've built the greater segments of our language and literature. But I know that story would have been told. What I wanted to talk about was what has been, I think, airbrushed out of our history. There's been by and large, not in this congregation, I'm sure, but there's been by and large in this country over the last 50, 100, and stretching back a couple of hundred years, an increasing secularization, an increasing indifference, sometimes deep opposition to religion, and the development of powerful atheism. And in the course of challenging and bringing down and undermining and dismissing the faith, a lot of what the Bible did alongside the faith has also been dismissed. And this seems to me to be a crime against history, our history. I use the word crime to be a little dramatic, but I also think it is. If we lose the notion of where we've come from and how we built up to what we are now, then I think we're embalmed in the superficiality of the present, really. And I went and looked and followed up hunches that I had, which some of which proved to be true, and just one or two, I wanted to explore the influence of the Bible on the development of democracy. It was absolutely crucial in the 17th century, and in this country, starting in this country and moving to America. I wanted to prove the influence of the Bible on one of the greatest things that has happened in the modern world, and perhaps the most generous act of policy in the history of humanity, and that is the abolition of slavery. And the influence of the King James Bible was central and crucial and can be charted on the part of the abolitionists as well as on the part of the fight they had against people who wanted to retain slavery or use the King James Bible, but most of all on the way the African-Americans got hold of the King James Bible and used it to bring their tribal languages into one language, turn it into liberation theology, turn it into gospel, and advance through the King James Bible. I wanted to show the influence that the King James Bible had on the empowerment of women and the development of social work in the 19th century. Again, you don't find it very much in histories that are written of that time and in that way. And on it went, even in its effect on early modern science in the 17th century. I think religion and the King James Bible had a powerful impact. So it was an act of restoration, an act of reclamation, if you want, more a history than a celebration of faith, although all along the way, without the faith, there wouldn't have been the history. So that's the reason, in the end, I tackled it. And it was it's a stretch, 400 years. But when I look at my good friend, who effortlessly goes over 3,000 years, I think I took a pinch of snuff.
Well, thank you for that. The act of writing about 3,000 years of Christianity was a sort of tribute to my past as well. I'm the third generation of clergy in my family, so I sort of span a large number of generations of Anglican history. And part of that was, of course, the King James Bible. It was always there in my childhood. I think I read it from cover to cover about the age of 10, chapter by chapter at night. What a little swot I was.
Good story.
Some of it is incredibly dull. Do try Deuteronomy, and do try Ezekiel, much of which is completely incomprehensible in any language. And I don't say that as an iconoclast. No less a person than the Lady Margaret Professor of Divinity in the University of Cambridge once said to me that she couldn't understand half of Ezekiel. Completely lost in meaning. But that's beside the point. There it is, as a great monument of our past, of our present, of our literature, of our language. And questions, it seems to me, of its truth are less important than its objective existence. And it seems to me that it's a bit like my own parents. And about your parents. Now, there is nothing that we can do about our mum and dad. They're just there. We may not agree with them, and as we grow up, we probably agree with them less and less. Though in the end, we may find that they said more sense than we thought to start with. But they're there. They are what you might call canonical. You can't change your parents. And in the same way, you can't change the Bible. There is no sense in subtracting one book or adding another. And so it was with that thought in mind that I looked at 3,000 years of Christian history. There was the Bible in the middle of it, and for a lot of the time that was King James.
How did the King James Bible fit into other texts that you referred to in that book of yours?
Well, I'd pick up your remarks about Tyndale because I couldn't agree more. And I think the oddity about Tyndale is that it's one person whose aim is to completely translate the Bible. Now, I think we forget just how odd that is. The Bible is normally, in its history, translated by committees. Right back to the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. That was a committee. I mean, famously, it's supposed to be 72 rabbis in 72 days translating the Bible, each doing a complete translation. It miraculously turns out to be the same in all the 72 cases. Well, all that is saying is that they were jolly clever guys who wrote a pretty good translation. And that's the first committee. Then you get the Lollards, who in effect were a committee translating it for the first time into English. And then we've got the committee of the King James. And in the middle, there is this individual. And what an extraordinary stroke of luck that it's Tyndale. I think there are two things about Tyndall. First, there is the scholarship. I mean, he could have fitted into the constellation of talent in our theology faculty today and held his own. Greek and Hebrew, very unusual combination, in addition to Latin at the time.
And Anglo-Saxon.
And Anglo-Saxon too. Yeah, I mean, he did understand the prehistory of his own work. But more than that, the missing dimension of that is his childhood. Now, we now know that Tyndall came from the Forest of Dean in Gloucestershire. We always knew he came from Gloucestershire, but we were under the misapprehension he grew up on the scarp of the Cotswolds, and that's the wrong side of Gloucestershire. John Fox tells us that he grew up on the borders of Wales. Now, you can't say the Cotswolds, the borders of Wales. He was ordained in the Diocese of Hereford, and the only part of Gloucestershire at the time in the Diocese of Hereford was the Forest of Dean. Now, why am I laboring that pedantically? Well, it is because, of course, he was hearing two languages all through his boyhood in the marketplaces at Chepstow or wherever. He's hearing two languages, and the fascination of that must have been huge, I think.
Yeah, I discovered Tyndall many years ago, and as a non-scholar, but somebody interested in this, sort of tried to find out more about him and the influence he'd had, and read the Tyndall Bible, the version of the Bible, and found one or two others who really knew what they were talking about. There were two or three things. I mean, Dermot's given the sweep, and that matters enormously. One thing to say is that we were, and as Dermot's mentioned this, we were just fortunate to have, as a translator, a man of genius, to find the drop of words in prose and the rhythms in, say, the Beatitudes, both of which are the backbone of so much English-speaking literature in this country, in America, in Australia, wherever you go. He just could do it, just as Shakespeare could do it. And Tyndall had a massive influence on Shakespeare. I know that Tyndall died in the 1530s and Shakespeare, and Tyndall, the King James Bible came out in 1611, Shakespeare died in 1615, but the King James Bible in the New Testament was 85% Tyndall. And Shakespeare had heard that in his church in the Geneva Bible in Stratford-upon-Avon. And so he went on, Tyndall influenced Shakespeare. But there's one really important thing I think about Tyndall that's crucial. He said once in an argument in his 20s when he was failing to get jobs, he seems to have been a rather shy but very determined man, utterly dedicated to putting the Bible into the English language. Totally dedicated, like his great hero Erasmus was. And he used an image that Erasmus had used. And the image was of the ploughboy. And he said to the bishop, I will teach a ploughboy to understand the Bible as well as thee. And the ploughboy is an extraordinary reference for two reasons. First of all, it's the boy, the youth, and tilling the land, which harks back to the apostles, the ordinary people doing ordinary jobs that Christ gathered in, which would have resonated and mattered. But secondly, and even more crucially, the ploughboy was illiterate. And Tyndall wrote a Bible to be spoken, to be understood by the illiterate. And that again and again through the centuries, especially when you go to America, it has the most powerful effect. And to their credit, those 52 or 47 were they scholars who put the King James Bible together, when they put the final version together, they didn't pass notes to each other, they sat around and they followed it and they read it aloud to each other. And it is a preaching, speaking Bible. And perhaps, I don't know enough about other religious books to know whether that's the case, but it's the key case, and it's been a key factor in its power, in language, the spread of its ideas. And that's one of the great things Tyndall did.
How much did they argue when they were reading the text?
I think it's Dermot's talk, time.
Well, we hear them arguing in a document which you'll see in the exhibition in the Bodleian Library, because there is a minute of a discussion of part of the Bible. It's not one of the most prominent books, but you see the cut and thrust of argument there, and the thought of alternative translation. So we do have a sense of what happens when they do this solemn reading, and that you're absolutely right, I'm sure. And that gives me a chance to plug a third person in the 16th century who I think is crucial. We've mentioned Tyndall, we've mentioned Shakespeare, and I'm going to add Thomas Cranmer, because there is the author of a liturgy. I say author, the chairman of a committee which creates a liturgy, and a very directive chairman, I think, who creates something which is to be performed. The Book of Common Prayer is not to be read as a piece of literature. It's one of the very few books which, until very recently, had no page numbers. Why should it? You just read particular services at particular times. You don't need to know it's page 63. And it's a performance script. And that, I think, is part of the words which your translators of 1611 had in their minds. Every day, not just every Sunday, they would perform the Book of Common Prayer, and so would the people of England. This is a book for the performance of an entire nation. And that, of course, in the middle of it, has the reading of the Bible alongside the words of Cranmer and his now virtually unknown team of committee men in 1549-52.
Do you want to go? Shall we pursue your agenda?
Yes, time is pushing on us, yes.
You said, why was it such a... You were going to ask me why it was such a success in the 17th century, the King James Bible.
Well, yes, I mean, you're presenting yourself the huge worldwide success, aren't you?
Yeah, and I think there are several in the 17th century. The translation and the translations in the 16th century, once after deep theological brooding, Henry VIII had turned to Protestantism, and all the books, the Bible, should be in English in the churches. They had roared away to some extent. Most of all, the Geneva Bible. It was cheap, it was small, and it was largely written by Tyndall, which meant that people took to it and liked it and wanted to read it. In the 17th century, I think, and Dermot will amplify this and rift it with scholarship, after the King James Bible was published, and after the king made sure that other Bibles were taken out of churches so that his Bible was a monopoly Bible and forced it on the churches, after that happened, it was taken up into politics in the broadest possible way. The politics of the Civil War, in which the most pamphleted political and battleground that there had been until then and perhaps since. And the battle was fought through the Bible. The Bible in English, the King James Version, liberated thousands of people in this country into thought. And they used it for their arguments. And they used examples from it for their arguments. They didn't say, let's kill the king. They couldn't do that. We have to imagine a people who every bit as clever as we were, but they could not say that. It wasn't the way that they thought in those days. But they could say, look what God did to tyrants in the Old Testament. Look what happened in Babylon. And use examples from the Old Testament. Everybody knew what they were talking about, but they were not saying, let's kill King Charles I, the divinely appointed king. And that's just a small example of how they used the Bible again and again in their political discussions. There were these campfire discussions, which Durbin knows about, which, curious enough, happened again in the American Civil War in absolutely precisely the same way, before battles. And people describe the tents being crowded and not being able to get in precisely the same language, in both those civil wars. And what they were talking about before Naseby and so on was not the battle of the next day, but whether they were justified, whether God was justifying this war, whether they were going into battle for the right reasons, and using the Bible the entire time. It became completely laced into, rifted into, their view of the world. And out of that came the extraordinary thing of a legal trial of a king in the Great Hall that Obama spoke in, a legal trial of a divinely appointed king, which I think is the first time it had happened in history, and he was found guilty and executed. That shook the world because he was no longer above the law. And then the Putney debates a few years later took up the idea that smallest he as an equal in the kingdom with the greatest he, and democracy began to roll forward. So I think it took flight because it bit into the politics, it bit into the thought, it bit into the serious literature. You have Milton at that time, for example. And as it went on, people continued to find it not only useful, but authoritative. And it drove them, as I mentioned, the slavery case and all other cases. It found a place in society people might say miraculously, alongside its place in church. And I think those two things combine to give it an extraordinary power in the English-speaking world and then to America and then around the world in many ways. And I think it's that those combinations that got going. And the idea, the profound idea of liberation that this strange, confused, contradictious book allowed people to get from it.
I'd want to take you up on this question of why it should become, the King James Bible should become a worldwide success. Because the civil war about which you're speaking, that could have been a civil war between two English Bibles. It could have been the Geneva Bible of the Puritans against the King James Bible of the Royalists. And it wasn't. And that's an extraordinary thing. You'd have thought that this book would be a Royalist symbol in the Civil War, and it is not. It is already a non-partisan book. And I think that's very interesting. And that after the death of the king, after Oliver Cromwell had presided over the death of King Charles, Oliver Cromwell issued an edition of the King James Bible. So it is not identified with the extremely unsatisfactory Charles I. It is the property of his father, who by comparison is a model king.
Why did James make the Bible such an important part of his state?
Well, it's a piece of politics. And the politics are that it's he has some extremely godly and zealous subjects. And they are inclined to be extremely stroppy, particularly the clergy. He first found this in Scotland. Remember, he's King James VI of Scotland. And at the General Assembly of the Kirk in 1601, which was likely to be a stroppy event, they usually were General Assemblies, he proposed a new translation of the Bible. And the ministers were delighted. The first thing they approved of, the king had ever said. And it took the heat out of that discussion, and James did not forget that. Although 1601 was not the moment, 1604, when he'd become King James I of England, he did the same trick again. He gathered the bishops and the stroppy Puritans at a single meeting at Hampton Court, and amid all the rows, he said, one thing we might all agree on is translating the Bible. And so it went. Curious thing is, though, I was reading the introduction to this, which is the facsimile, 1611, issued by OUP. You can buy it for about £100. The introduction preface from the translators to the reader is rather combative. It doesn't do what you might think King James would want it to do, which is to make peace. In fact, it talks about, I paraphrase, those stroppy Puritans.
Well, he disliked, he'd had enough of Puritans. I mean, he said he would visit Scotland many times when he left, and he went back once, reluctantly. He found lush England far too seductive to leave. But he'd had the Bible drummed into him. He was said when he was 8 he could translate any verse, open the Bible at any page, he could translate any verse into 3 languages. He was proud of his scholarship, which was real. He was a scholar, James VI and I, and he was a biblical scholar, and he spoke for a whole day at that Hampton Court conference in 1604. His first speech lasted a day about the Bible to show how good he was at the Bible. Reynolds, the Puritan Presbyterian, was the man who suggested the Bible, and he leapt on it for all the reasons you say. But the curious combativeness, I think, is because he was exactly everything you've said about bringing people together through the Bible. But also, he had had enough of being harassed by these Presbyterians in Scotland, where he couldn't move for being harassed, told off. He'd been a king since he was 1 year old, and they'd been telling him off ever since he could talk. And when he came to England, he thought, this is wonderful. This is the land of milk and honey. I needn't be told off anymore. And one of the things that kept telling him off was the Geneva version, not because of the translation by Tyndale, but because of the marginal notes. And the marginal notes were full of hellfire against tyrants, i.e. people like James VI of Scotland. And he made a rule that tyrant was omitted from the King James Bible and replaced by king. But the combativeness, I suggest, you know more than that, is that he's still in the back of his mind trying to get those Puritans and get rid of the Geneva Bible. But it is remarkable because the Geneva Bible was so loved that the King James Bible did take over. One of the reasons is that it was forced into churches by King James. He wanted his Bible to be in the church.
But I think it's also, it comes out at just the right moment. King James was bringing the Scottish church and the English church together, bit by bit. I mean, he knew the psychology of his Scottish ministers. And it was just the moment where you could bring a new translation to both churches. And I think it's crucial that the Scots took to it. And one of the reasons is I think it is so old-fashioned at the time. Now, old-fashioned London English, that which is old-fashioned down in London in 1611, is actually not old-fashioned in Edinburgh. And for the Scotsman to hear a slightly archaic form of English is reassuring. And I think it helped the ministers in a Scottish service actually perform the book in Scots, because they had a vocabulary from 100 years before, and then it could bed down. I'm sure they performed it in a language which would be virtually incomprehensible to a London bishop.
There was criticism at the time, I think I'm right in saying, that the King James Version wasn't a literal translation, word for word. But of course, some of the expressions that we now take for granted in English, reaping the whirlwind, feet of clay, we take from that translation. What would expressions like that have been if they'd been translated literally?
Well, I can't, without my book, I can't bring enough comparisons to mind. Wycliffe's translation, which, and his group of people, the Lollards, again in this university, the Bible in English is very much an Oxford phenomenon with Wycliffe and then Tyndall, and on it goes right up to Wesley and so on, to today, really, one way or another, with Dearman himself. I think that Tyndall would have said he did give a precise translation. Scholarship advanced in many ways, and they said, no, that wasn't precise enough, it had to be reshaped in this way, and a new word. Lancelot Andrews, whom T.S. Eliot greatly admires, amplified certain sentences, warmed certain sentences, and according to T.S. Eliot, made certain phrases better. I slightly disagree, but then who am I compared with Lancelot Andrews? I think that by getting Hebrew and Anglo-Saxon together, and he wrote Tyndall that there was a very strong relationship between Hebrew and Anglo-Saxon, particularly the relation to monosyllables. By getting those together, I think he thought, and his translation again is full of monosyllables. That's wonderful, simplest words to understand. He thought that he was doing it accurately. Further translations, further trawlings of other previous translations brought amendations and qualifications to it. But that's as far as I can go. Dermot can probably tell you more.
Well, one could think of various examples. Mess of Pottage is one. I remember the Birthright, which is sold from Mess of Pottage. Well, it rather disappointingly just means a dish of lentils. And that's how Luther translated it into German. I don't think it sounds nearly as good, really, as a mess of pottage. But presumably that was a fairly colloquial phrase in the early 16th century, and it's meant to sound even more dismissive than the literal meaning. Just a cheap meal. He sold his birthright for a cheap meal.
But the fall of the words is again and again what gets you, Tyndall. I mean, there are many ways of saying, I'm not responsible for, I needn't look after, why should I take care of? But to say, I'm not my brother's keeper, he just thinks, yes. And that is again and again and again and again. And the rhythms, I maintain, the rhythms in the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor, I mean, that is the rhythm that inhabits most English poetry, or much English poetry, from then on. So,
And
Martin Luther King's speeches, exactly.
One should take Melvin's point very seriously, that this has always been a Bible to be performed, to be read aloud. And that can't change in podcast form. And that, in a sense, gives it a strength. My other point about the end of the road was the vast proliferation of translations since the 1880s, but particularly since the 1960s. The New English Bible, the New International Version, the Revised Standard Version. There's a Bible for addicts. There's a Bible for busy moms. And all sorts of vernacular translations, particularly in the United States, all of which are meant to make the Bible easy. And there is no doubt that a lot of the King James Bible is now difficult. For all the great phrases Melvin's referred to, there are very difficult parts within it. It's not impossible to understand now, but it takes an effort. Now, that, I think, is one reason for saying that it's not the end of the road. It is not a good reason to get rid of the King James Bible for an easy-to-understand version, because it says something very important about the Bible, that it is not an easy text. I think what Protestants found when they heard Tyndale's inspiring phrase about the ploughboy is that the trouble about the ploughboy is that he will take a meaning and run with it, rather as your slaves ran with a meaning they found in it, which their slave owners didn't like. Well, not if you're a slave owner, it isn't. And this is a book which has profound problems within it. And it seems to me that that's one of the great things about it. It is not a book, it's a library of books. Now, I think, look, you're disagreeing with me now, Melvin.
With the greatest respect.
Now the life will go.
I very rarely say that. I do mean it. I couldn't have more respect for you. I just disagree completely. I totally and utterly disagree. First of all, there are parts of it that are difficult, yes. So what are teachers and preachers for? That's the answer to that. Most of it is not difficult. Most of it is monosyllabic. Most of it is very straightforward. The important bits are very easy to understand. That's one thing I'd say. Secondly, it assumed the nature, as I think you said, Lord Chancellor, of a national book, a sacred book, because it was a national book. We are one of the few countries ever to have had a national book. And so it gathered around it much more than authority as something that preached a particular faith. It had the authority that spoke for a particular country and a particular way of life. Because one of the things about the Bible is that it's so deep, steeped in contradictions. You can take all sorts of things from it, and that's the strength of it. So I don't think it's difficult, and I do think it has another purpose outside faith. But most of all, I think that the idea that something that has gone on for 400 years now, but started to die away 50 or so years ago, and letting it go is a terrible thing for us to do. It's a terrible thing for us to do. It is, I do beg your pardon, but still I'm going to say this. And I think that the decline of the Anglican Church has marched step in step with the decline of usage of the King James Bible, and that is not an accident, it seems to me. And what we have is a mistake which can be rectified. What if we decided that, yes, we still want churches, we want places where people can worship, but this is inconvenient, it's too big, it's too drafty, let's knock it down and build a prefab, it's much more convenient. We don't do that. What if we decided that Shakespeare, why is Shakespeare now more sacred than the Bible? What if we decided that Shakespeare was too difficult? What if we decided, to be or not to be, that is a question, whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the strings and arrows of outrageous slings and arrows of outrageous fortune? That's really difficult. So you should say to this sixth former, no, we can't have that. You should say something like, look, I'm really stressed. I've had the most terrible day, and back home you've no idea. Oh, yeah, well, let's do that then. Let's destroy Shakespeare. We don't do that. So what have we done that to this book for? Other translations, absolutely fine. As many as you want, for mums and dads and whatever, that's fine. But keep that one there. Keep it present. Keep it active. And those who are responsible for it, the people who run our churches, should be the most devoted to keeping that like that. Because what about our children and their children and the lining of their minds? We're depriving them of something that it won't do. We shouldn't do that.
Melvin, I think we're fiercely agreeing here.
With great respect.
because you've made my point. You say that this book is full of contradictions.
Yes.
It is. And you're right about the language, but within it there are a multitude of messages, many of which are contradictory. Let's face it, the Bible is one of the chief props of slavery. And you're also right that it's one of the chief solvents of the idea of slavery. Paul doesn't challenge slavery. He even tries to wheedle a slave out of Philemon.
Well, just a second. I think you made a very good point about slavery, but the fact is, this is a fact. For every civilization that has been recorded that we know of in the history of civilization, there has been slavery. It has been thought of as part of the natural condition of mankind. And in the 19th century, it was abolished. It still exists, but it's no longer considered to be part of the natural. And the instrument that abolished it was the Bible. Now, the Old Testament is full of slavery, and those who held on to slavery used it. But from the New Testament, Wilberforce and others got their arguments, and most of all, the African Americans got hold of the Bible, and they saw it as a liberation. They saw it as something that released them. So the contradictions are important. Sometimes great books are made great by their contradictions. In it was enough to get rid of, perhaps, one of the great abominations in our passage as human beings over the last 6,000 or 7,000 years. And it came out of the King James Bible. It doesn't matter that there's opposition. What it matters is that the good guys win. And the good guys won on that, and they won through the King James Bible.
Well, it is, I think, an age of the Enlightenment. And what the Enlightenment did, I think this is also another unique feature of our culture, is that we are able to step back from our own culture and look at it as if it is another culture. That's really the central idea of the 18th century Enlightenment. You step back from all you hold dear and scrutinize it as if it were ancient Babylon. Now, if you do that, then the canonical book, which is part of All You Hold Dear, is also going to be scrutinized. And it seems to me that one of the greatest achievements of the human intellect has been Western Protestantism's encounter with the Bible, having thought that from the late 18th century, German scholars in particular were looking at this text and saying, what on earth is it saying up there? How did it get to that point? And yet, at the end of it, there are still Western Protestant Christians prepared to live with it, perhaps in the analogy of my mum and dad. I can't change them, can't change this book. That is canonicity. It's not quite the same canonicity as might have been thought of in the medieval church or the 4th century church, but it is canonicity. It is about identity. My identity is caught up with this text, and that can never change, whatever I make of it.
I think one of the extraordinary things about it is that it can mean so much, it can do so much good and so much harm. We haven't mentioned the harm, the impact of harm it's done. There's been a lot of harm in the name of the Bible, but then there's been a lot of harm in the name of every religion and no religion and indifference and atheism and whatever you like. So I don't count that as a necessary big slur against the King James Bible itself. I think there was a time, yeah, right, you're talking about history. There was a time when this was sort of the history of the world, until quite recently in our civilization. People did, even people at the birth of modern science in the 1650s, they thought that this was the history of the world. And we have to have the grace to respect that time and to imagine, and history is to do with imagination as much as anything else, to imagine that people like Hooke and Wren and Boyle and that thought in that way, that the Old Testament told them the history of the world. Now, you can't be much cleverer than those people, but they thought that. So for them, it was a real history, and it was a real history for the slaves in America, very much a real history. So that held for a very long time. It doesn't hold now. The German scholars, as Dermot has pointed out, were the ones who chipped that away, and then they had a big influence on George Eliot, among others. So the history went. As for lovely language than that. It has lined the language. It's more than just lovely language. That we speak as we're speaking now, if we speak at our best, and we write as we're writing now, for 400 years of development on a language that was displayed in that book and in Shakespeare. With others came in, of course they did. The Book of Common Prayer, which David mentioned, is another example. These are the pillars, and that's a big thing. But one thing that interested me, two things. I've mentioned that alongside its impact as a book of faith, it did impact on society in ways which we are very, very reluctant to recognize these days because we don't want it to. It doesn't fit in with the way we look at life. But it did. I've mentioned slavery, I've mentioned democracy, the women's movement in the 19th century, and so on and so forth. And one more thing. It seems to me that we live in an age which quite clearly believes that atheistic rationality is the pinnacle of perception. That's that. Well, that's one view, and it takes you a long way. It takes you a very long way, and the arguments are good. But I think that I would rather agree with Martin Rees and Stephen Hawking, not to deny that, but to give it a limitation, and to say, as both those great scientists say, there are things we shall never know. There are things that we, the mind, will never stretch to. There will always be the inexplicable. And I think we have intimations of the inexplicable. Pulsars coming to us, surprised by joy, or in particular moments of passion, depression, whatever it is. And they're out there. And I'm not saying that if we break through that barrier, there will be a man with a big white beard, or there will be God, but there is something else. And I can't accept that reason is the only way and then now the sole way forward to look at the world. I can't believe that in the next 300, 400, 500 years, maybe before then, but certainly then, that notion will be amended or expanded or qualified in many ways. And there'll be other ways to look at the world. And I think in that sense, books which carry faith, as well as wisdom, as well as moral messages, as well as stories, and the Bible does all that, will still have a use, will still be able to circulate in the minds of people who are trying to find out the best they can, the most they can, about the human condition.
Yeah, I'd say amen to all that, but theologians present will probably know the question posed by Leonard Hodgson, which I think is a very splendid answer to your dilemma, because it recognizes the dilemma. The question is, if that is how the truth appeared to them then, what must be the truth for us now? That gives a full respect to the text, and yet it says that something has happened, history, which puts us in a different position, but it's a position in relation to a truth. The truth of the biblical text is there, we are there, the truth is there. And that seems to me to splendidly answer the problem of canonicity. But I back up everything that Melvin has said. And what seems to me to be missing in the Dawkins, let's name him, approach to metaphysics, shall we say, is the lack of wonder. There is no wonder. And wonder seems to me to be the basic solvent of pride. And pride is the ultimate human sin. And so with a sense of wonder, then we can at least do something to tackle our sin. And that sin is pride.
I agree with that. And as an example, Dawkins, and curiously enough, the Oxford story continues, doesn't it? From Wycliffe to Dawkins. But you have a sense of wonder missing. And I want a specific example. In his book, The God Delusion, I want to qualify, I want to introduce this by saying, I like Richard Dawkins, I know him, and whenever I've met him, we've got on very well together. He's taught me an immense amount about subjects I knew very little about because of his skill as a teller of stories and as a scholar. That's incontestable in my view. I think he abandons an awful lot of that, I'm sorry to say, in The God Delusion, and he just takes swipes. And this notion of wonder that Diamond has raised, and I'm glad he's raised, is present there, and it's one of the things that most offended me. There's quite a lot that offended me, but this offended me. Not because I'm like Einstein, which quoted in Dawkins' book, I'm a religious, a a religious non-believer a new sort of faith, he said. Anyway, that's as may be. But when Dawkins was speaking of past religions, he spoke of the Australian Aborigines, and he said they were masters of survival, superb survivalists, that's his phrase, superb survivalists. What a pity that they had all this clutter, that's his word, which is a generous word to use for it, that's his phrase. He meant the dream songs. And I just thought, I was so disappointed, because you absolutely have to wonder and be amazed at that Stone Age people in deserts with nothing going for them, trying to explain and understand why children were born and died in 2 seconds, why there was lightning, why there were droughts, why there were sudden floods, why life was as it was. And everything we know about Homo sapiens since he started being Homo sapiens is that this curiosity that people want to understand, they fabricate systems. And they fabricated this wonderful system, the dream songs, the dream ideas. People who know much more about it do. I don't understand it. Maybe sometime in future one will. It took hundreds and thousands of years to understand some things. But more importantly, they had this amazing system that they'd constructed for themselves. And who's to say that without that system, they would not have been superb survivalists? Because that system itself of why we live and why we're here informed their minds and gave their minds hope, gave them freshness, gave them the idea to go on. And the idea of wonder at that is something that I think he should have, Professor Dawkins should have had. And again it happens. It shows no respect for people every bit as clever as us. It shows no respect for great bodies of knowledge that would just happen at the moment not be able to understand. And to say it's useless clutter, come back in 4,000 or 5,000 years' time and look at what we're doing now. You could probably describe that in much the same terms. But I hope people in 4 or 5 years' time will have the courtesy to say, well, it's interesting what they were trying to do, these people, at the beginning of the 21st century. They were trying to do this and that and the other. They were getting it all wrong, but that doesn't matter very much. This is what they were trying to do. It's just right their way, they were trying to fiddle their way or work their way through this business that we're in of being born and dying. And so I do think the lack of wonder is the big affliction.
Theology as a system is invented in the 12th century. It is not the essence of the Christian faith. It's a way of approaching the God problem invented by Western theologians. And that is not the way that most of Christian history has seen the problem of God. What most of Christian history has had has been the same book which we have. And that unites us with the past. That's why history is important, because it consists of a multitude of eyes looking at the perennial problem of our existence at different stages. And to dismiss history is actually to dismiss the way that Christianity works. Christianity is not a system, it is a question.
A question which you can take off into the summer evening and discuss over supper. Can I thank you all for coming this evening? I'd like to thank Professor McCulloch for, as ever, being wise and thoughtful and provocative. He is one of the jewels in the crown of the theology department and indeed the university. And it's been delightful to spend an hour in his company again. And I'd like to pay a particular vote of gratitude to Melvin Bragg, who's been a tremendous supporter of this university, who unfailingly supports the university on occasions like this. Gave a brilliant lecture not long ago at Wadham, where he's an honorary fellow and I think also a Domus Fellow of St. Catherine's. He's been a great supporter of the university, and it's been terrific that he's managed to tear himself away from the House of Lords today. Thank you.